This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
These criminals were charismatic and they had, you know, this lifestyle, the nice clothes, and looked like life was just one big good time.
Welcome back to Motive and Method. I'm Zanthi Malich.
And I'm Tim Watson-Munro.
In the last episode, we were speaking to Russell Manser, who's had a very interesting and diverse history, having gone to a boys' home as a 15-year-old. The experiences of sexual abuse there really changed the focus of his life. And then we heard the rest of Russell's story, bringing him right up to what he does today, which is advocate for other prisoners, especially those who have been sexually abused. So we've talked a lot about his background and his history and how he's come to the point of where we are today. So in this episode, which is in essence part two of talking to Russell, we're going to look at now how he's changing other people's lives. So welcome back, Russell. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. How can we better educate the public about the harsh realities of the criminal justice system? I mean, from my observation over years and years, my view has always been the punishment is the deprivation of liberty. But a lot of people out there think that that's just at the beginning of it all, and people who go to jail should be subjected to brutality, sexual brutality, daily punishment, and so on. How do we better educate, and I assume this is part of what you're doing with your advocacy work, the general public about all this sort of stuff?
I'm living proof when you get it right. Like, I'm a big believer in, when I see them talking about getting tough on crime and reducing crime rates, I mean, I'm a big believer. If you treat society's trauma, and the crime rate's going to drop, it's going to drop that way, and proof will be of it, you know. It's really hard because, you know, even, like, I've done a lot of work on myself. I'm the blueprint for when you do get it right. You know, this is what you can achieve. And I still have people coming at me and saying, no, like, I get these people on, in particular on social media, and go, what do you say to your victims? I say, what do I say to my victims? I say, look at the work I'm doing. It shows you how remorseful I am. Remorse ain't words. Remorse ain't, oh, listen, I'm sorry. It's not like school. You write out, I'm sorry 1,000 times and things are going to change and people are going to forgive you. Remorse is, you know, it for me is just my behavior. And my behavior is these days, through hard work, like I started that trauma counselling and it was a game changer for me. And I thought, when I was in it and what my thought process was, the antidote to trauma is love, yeah? You know, And what comes out of love is self-belief, self-worth and all those other beautiful things, you know what I mean? After the abuse took place, I didn't have none of them sort of things, and it was through the trauma counselling that I realised it wasn't my fault, you know, that I am worthy, and I'm worthy of love, and and that self-belief, and all of these things that come, these beautiful things, these beautiful flowers that grew in my garden through the trauma counselling change thing. And if it can happen to me, it can happen to all these other people. Through the work I do, you know, I get some of the most violent offenders come through my organisation, the Voice of the Survivor, and tell me their story. And I've had the beauty of being able to sit back and watch these people go through the process and change their whole thought pattern and their whole behaviour pattern. I've been out doing what I've been doing for 6 years now. So I've had the beauty of being able to watch it. And even in my own life, I don't have them thoughts. I don't have thoughts of doing criminal stuff. I don't have a propensity for violence no more. I walk away from things. I have better coping methods and strategies in place to live my life on a fruitful daily basis.
Can you tell us a bit more about that and the kind of charity that you set up to help other people who have been through similar things, I guess, to you?
Yeah, it's not a charity. It's an organisation. My organisation does, you know, we make money out of it. But what happens is people all come to us, in particular through, you know, word of mouth about my own story and my own, you know, my own journey. And for the first time in a lot of cases, I had a really high profile boxer tell me the other night, I was the first person that he ever told about his sexual abuse. So they come to us and say, look, and this is what happened to us. And I said, okay, right. So what we'll do is we're going to build a support strategy around that person, which includes, you know, put them in contact with a lawyer. You know, we've got a couple of psychologists that are attached to what we do, and we're gonna support these people while they go through the court process and you know, through the compensation process in particular. So we'll line them up with a lawyer that's trauma-informed. And, you know, we've butted heads with lawyers over the years. But how this happens, so we create the platform for them to tell their story. So we interview them, and it comes out as a report of the abuse, a report of what happened to them. It's all recorded and transcribed what happened to them in the report. So we've got people, two lawyers that will interview these people. We will then, we'll send it over to the lawyers. The lawyers will sign them up. No win, no pay, cost agreement. But we're going to support them through the whole process. So that can be quite daunting. So, they go to a psych report. We're contacting them. We're making sure and they're going to be fine before and after it. We'll do it. And they go to a barrister's appointment. We'll make sure that being fine and, to their mediation and ongoing. We connect them to support services that we're in contact with. Make sure they're okay, And at the moment, I've got 17,400 clients in 6 years.
17,000?
Wow.
17,000, yeah, 17,000.
All ex-prisoners?
No, not necessarily. It's starting to balance out. Initially, it was about 90 to 10%. Now we're coming in all about 50-50 to people in the community through a lot of stuff I've done on social media, through, podcasts and interviews that I've done, in particular social media. Well, I tell my story and encourage people to, because I've got a few slogans. I say a perpetrator's greatest weapons is victim silence and shame. And when I tell my story, I'm handing the backpack I've carried for my whole life back to its rightful owner, and that's the perpetrators themselves, And
And how has that advocacy changed you? Because I imagine it must have done, hearing all these stories.
Look, yeah. I was on the front line for maybe the first 1,400 interviews. I've done them personally. And Professor Coyle wrote a report to the Sydney District Court saying that, you'd only ever come across two people that could work on this line, me and Hetty Johnson, and not be traumatised by it. And actually, it's been cathartic for me. And there's a man and a woman called Hetty Johnson who runs Bravehearts. But, I can remember the last interview I'd done. It was with a mate of mine, a bloke who's serving life in Queensland, and I'd done his trauma interview and I just said to my business partner, I can't do them no more, I'm not doing them no more, and I hang it up.
It was too graphic, too confronting.
Yeah, it was...
Burnout?
Yeah, I was in burnout stage to the point, I relapsed on drugs and hadn't used drugs for a long time. It just affected me in a way that I'd never seen coming, I was so close to home. And because of it was a mate I had and I knew where it took place, I was like I was watching a movie of it happening. I could disassociate myself from that in the past, and I could disassociate myself. I could do an interview and go, yeah, that's sweet, that's over, and thought nothing more of it ever again. But that one I couldn't escape. It was just too graphic for me and it was too close to home, and I just said to him, I can't do it. And, it affected me in a pretty bad way, to the point when I put myself in a rehab for a month.
So do you think it was that particular story, or do you think literally at that point you were just, you just taken as much as you could take?
Yeah, I couldn't disassociate anymore, I think. I just got I think it was like filling up a 40-gallon drum full of water.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, the water's going to come out. You put a hose in it, and that's what it was. So the water started to come out, so... Beauty about it was I built some coping mechanisms, I built support around me. People knew I weren't well. That was different from any other time. People rallied around me to support me, got straight into rehab, done a month in rehab and just come out shining. And then...
you knew what to do and you had the resources to do it and access to those resources, which you certainly didn't have in your earlier life. I mean, I think you raise a really good point, and it's a point for all of us who work in this space. You need to debrief. You need someone to almost clinically supervise what you're doing so that you're not carrying the can all the time on your own, because otherwise you're vulnerable. I mean, it happened to me years ago. I know what happens. So.
Yeah, well, I had to restructure. And by this time, this is where the romantic part of my life kicks in. I was in a relationship with barrister Mary Keeney, who's Mary. I don't know. We hung out. She was a barrister in private practice. After about 12 months after I got out of prison, we were hanging out a fair bit. We ended up in a relationship together. We got dogs and we bought a farm. But I'm not easy to live with because I'm so I get triggered how people talk to me. if I think someone's talking to me like a prison officer, I can be really defensive. I can say, hang on, you don't need to talk to me like that. You know, if suffering reminds me, that's
where
my trauma.
You feel in a one down position, or it's something in the tone of the voice that triggers memories of all that stuff.
Well, Mary's a barrister, right? She asks questions for a living. I'm a criminal. I don't answer them. That's how, you know what I mean? You know, and that's, it was always that.
Sounds like a perfect relationship in some ways.
Oh, man. It's like, I come home and I feel like I'm being cross-examined. And it was like, hang on, I'm not a witness. If you're practicing, and that was always our trauma. That was, she's got her own trauma. And that was always that thing, you know, and like, you know, we break up, get back together, you know. I was talking to Charlie Waterstreet yesterday. I caught up with Charles Waterstreet the other day, because I'm getting him on my podcast, and
I know him well as well. Good bloke.
He's mad. I like Charlie, but anyway, I was talking to him about it, and he just goes, "It's just." He said to me, he goes, "The bank robber and the barrister, what a name of a movie," or something like that. You know what I mean?
It's true.
But she's just amazing, and I'm so blessed to have her in my life. Look, she was the one who planted the seed about doing the work at the Voice of a Survivor. She said, "You can do this," and I said, "I don't know how." She goes, "Just give it a go." And she was always really encouraging of me, just giving it a go. And she came with me to Coffs Harbour once. She said, "We'll buy a laptop." And I said, "What do I do?" I said, "I don't even know how to use it." And she goes, "You'll learn." You know, and slowly but surely I did. I started off the barbecue table to the point of employing 22 people a day, you know, 7,500 clients, working with 42 different law firms nationally.
And what have you learned through that process? How have you kind of grown?
Oh, man, I tell you, it's been tough because, you know, I've got these old things, like I've had a woman who worked for me and just robbed me, come in and robbed me blind, you know, and this is one of these law abiding, and they know that I'm never going to ring the police because that's not my gig, you know what I mean, you know, and that's why I've got a good reputation amongst inmates in prisons and everything like that. I'm not a police informer. I'd never do that. I'd never make that call, and so she knew I'd never do that. So, you know, 6 months down the track, I looked at the check in the bank account one day and went, wow. But, you know, and then people can steal your ideas. I've had people come in from me and steal all my intellectual property and start businesses on their own in opposition for me because they're all about money. I'm not, you know. Why people are better off coming to us and going directly to a lawyer? Look, one, it's cost effective. We're going to save them a shitload of money, like, because we're going to do basically the part one of the claim for them to the point, and we provide a trauma informed. But what I'll do, in particularly one, let's say, I think you can work it out, we're reading between a publicly listed law firm that we were working with initially, you know, charged a client $190,000 of a $410,000 claim on a first day mediation, unheard of.
Piracy
that was. So I've contacted them and I said, "You're going to have to take some." I said, "I know what that claim's worth, you know," and they don't realise. I've got Mary beside me calculating what the claim's worth, but like you know, in man hours type thing. And I said, that's a $30,000 claim. They said, no, what do you know? And I said, no. I said, all right, you're publicly listed and you're having problems with your share price and that at the moment. I think that tells everyone who the firm is. And I said, you're having problems with that? I said, man, you don't want the media to get hold of this one. I said, because it'll destroy us, you know. So long story short, I got $90,000 taken off that bill, you know, by to and froing for that client. And I think I could have got more done. And that's what I'll do. I want to work with firms that are going to treat our clients with dignity and respect and not just as commodity. And I'm forever on the phone talking to lawyers saying, hey, man, you can't say this. You can't. I'm not telling them not how to practice law. I'm telling them how to engage with our clients.
And do you think that's hard? Because obviously they're a vulnerable group, but ex-prisoners, you know, there'll be a perception and people will judge them. And do you think it's difficult doing the work you do, given that kind of broad perception by the general public and people you'll interact with professionally? Mm.
For sure. The problem is Queensland's a classic example of it. Queensland is the hardest place in Australia to get justice for survivors. In particular, you know, the jails won't let them have my phone number on their phone number. They had a parliamentary inquiry about claim farming and my organisation got thrown. I mean, we're not even lawyers, so, you know, we can't be sort of gauged as claim farming. If we're engaging, if someone's writing to us and ringing us and that sort of thing, it's not claim farming yet. But anyway, the law profession in Queensland weren't liking the fact that we were getting the majority of the claims coming for us and we were sort of saying where they were going. And Queensland's a place, there's some really underperforming lawyers up there that charge overperforming prices, you know what I mean? And so, I was encouraging blokes not to even use the lawyers up there. I was getting them to use the lawyers from out of state so you get a fairer go. So, you know, we got attacked by them, you know. They weren't liking it. And there's always someone, and there's always someone that thinks that they're being robbed.
Yeah, everyone wants to put you down, don't they?
Oh, 100%. You know that firsthand, Tim. You know it firsthand. It's always someone that wants to pull your partner. How about that? They threw a lot of mud for a long time. And like Mike Mary's always saying to me, she goes, at the end of the day, like, they were creating rumours that, oh, he's going to be charged by the police. Like, a year into the organisation, he's going to get charged by the police. Well, this is the longest investigation known to mankind. And, you know, I'll get one on social media going, oh, you're under investigation. How come I'm not being charged? How come the police never interviewed me? That's always that thing. It's always them stiffs that are always just trying to throw mud at me. And you know what? I'm glad they have, because it's made me more resilient.
You're stronger than that. After everything you've been through, you've got to be like Superman, I reckon.
I'm like that now, Adam. It's like,
I was going to say, has advocacy, the work you do as an advocate, has that further strengthened you? Has it empowered you? How has it changed you as a person, do you think? What are you doing now?
I tell you what, I know my purpose in life now. And look, I don't mean to get the tambourine out and bang the tambourine and sound like a hippie, but the universe has given me something. It acknowledged something, made me acknowledge something that I've got a purpose. And, you know, I think with every young kid, once we teach those kids what their find their purposes in their lives, that's what's the game changer for them, finding a purpose, what you're meant to be here, what you're meant to be doing, you know. But, yeah, I sit back sometimes and pinch myself and go, wow, you know. Like, I had breakfast with Mark Burris 2 mornings ago. I've become friends with him, and he put his arm around me and he said, mate, you're killing it. Like, just that Aussie slogan, mate, you are killing it. Look at you going. And, you know, I don't often sit back and think of that too much, because I'm aware of my ego. And if I start thinking like that, that ego of mine, it can be bigger than Blacktown and it can get out of control. And I don't want it. That's the thing I try to keep tame.
Before you know it, you're behind the wheel of a Porsche again.
Yeah, and off we go. You know, but I'm proud of what I've achieved. And to hear my kids say they're proud of it and that sort of thing, well. And plus, my dear old mum, she got to see, she was on a deathbed, and she got to see, we just bought our farm, which is just up near Byron there. And she got to see the real estate video of my farm. So just as she died. So,
well, that would have been wonderful for her to see how far you've come.
You said you're very conscious of the way people speak to you and show, you know, and things can kind of trigger you, just the way people will approach you. But do you think the work you're doing on podcasts and these other kind of reaching out to the public, do you think it can change that public perception of ex-prisoners and perhaps make people a little more empathetic or compassionate, less judgmental, understand that there's a backstory to a lot of these people's choices that maybe, if we'd all been in a different situation, many of us could have chosen that same path too.
110%. You're so right. And you know what? It's about that education. And I think at the end of the conversation, they go, oh, you know, because I have so many people contact me and go, man, thank you for educating me, because I was so narrow-minded. And I like to think I can broaden people's minds. And I like to think, oh, look, I've got the blueprint. And I'm a big advocate. Look, you want to, you know, I'm a big advocate. You want to reduce the crime rate, address the trauma. You know, I'm massive on it. I'm living proof of it. Scientifically, here I am. Here it is. Is the science, you know what I mean? I've just come out of the lab and this is what we've done. You know what I mean? What more can you do? Like, I'm getting some stuff now. I'm going to New Zealand, I think in September, to help their Royal Commission give some recommendations to their Royal Commission.
That's huge.
Yeah,
so you've become the Doyle. You know, and well recognised, and that's fantastic.
You know what, Tim? But it feels good too. It feels. I don't know if it's the ego that's feeling that, but it just feels good knowing that I'm doing good. You know, I live by the motto: I give more than I take, and I've never went without since I've done it. You know, and I try to do that. I'm really conscious of that. I give a lot of myself. Sometimes to the point of exhaustion. I can be up in social media, like doing lives on TikTok or Instagram until 11 o'clock at night, and sometimes I go to bed and I can feel it the next day, but I'm aware of me too now. You know, I'm aware of how I've got to nourish myself. You know, I'm aware of triggers.
So, what's the future for you now? I mean, you're involved in all this, obviously, incredible advocacy work, working with all these men, mostly men, are they?
No, look, you know, women too. I'm encouraging, you know. Okay. But it's a big disparity. There's like 75% men, 25% women.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, but I don't think that's reflective of the abuse. No. I think, you know.
Probably your story, people.
A lot of women get sexually abused.
Yeah. I think it's probably your story has drawn a lot of the guys in who were probably less likely to have talked about it, perhaps. So what's your future then? What does it hold for you?
I love the podcasting. I'm enjoying the podcasting. I love that. But, you know, Melbourne and South Australia have really low in numbers of abuse people abuse survivors talking. So I really want to go down there. But change. I'd love to be a part of this change in this youth crime rate because I think I've got a lot of the answers. But you know what? I can't even get a blue card to work with children because I've got violence on my criminal history. And I'll tell you something now. Them kids are going to listen to me more than they're going to listen to some cop with a clipboard telling them they're going to get 6 months penal servitude for stealing a car. Them kids don't listen to them people.
No, I agree with that entirely. It's like I said earlier, the real message is listened to when it comes from lived experience. Not from square heads who are sort of going, well, you know, if you keep doing this, you're going to get into trouble. You've walked the walk, and guess what? You've come out the other side, and you've been incredibly generous today with your time and so on. I know Xanth wanted to talk to you a bit about her justice clinic at the University of Newcastle, so I'll cut to her.
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to say to you, I mean, I'm so impressed by the work that you do. And at the University of Newcastle, we run a justice clinic and we do innocence work, working with people who claim to be wrongfully convicted. But we also work with victims, families, long-term missing persons cases, or cases where people feel that their death of a loved one may have been misclassified as suicide, for example, when it's actually suspicious. And certainly if there's anything that we can do to help you, then we would love to be involved with the work that you do, especially around obviously the youth justice and reducing crime rates and dealing with that trauma. So if we can help, then I'd love you to reach out.
I'd love to be able to, like, anytime you need me to address your students or anything like that. I've done a bit now with Stephen Allnut at Sydney University. I've done a little bit of work with him. I've done a couple of mental health things and that. I'll go out to schools. I've been going to the troubled school here at Waterloo with these kids. But anything I can ever do, like if you ever need me to get on there, and man, I appreciate you guys, you know. I love, because it's all about education for me. And I like to spread, hey, man, like, you know, before you, the one that scares me is these rednecks. Like Bob Catter's done some post the other day about slapping them in the head, and if they get up, slap them down again. Well, that's a child abuser. Why is that bloke even in Parliament?
Yeah, I saw that.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, I saw that. And
we were violently attacking these kids and that. You're just going to create a more violent offender.
For sure. And I would definitely catch up with you about that when you've got some time, and we'd love to talk to you more about that.
Yeah.
But I guess for now we just need to thank you for your time. It's been amazing hearing from you, and I really look forward to hearing everything you do in the future, because I think it's incredible. And I think the community is lucky to have you and people like you who are willing to stand up and speak and give a voice to other people when they may not have had that opportunity.
And if I could add to that, great courage, deep respect for what you've done in terms of turning your life around. And look, my dance card is always overflowing, but if I can ever be of any assistance to you, please call me. It's a great pleasure to meet you, Russell. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this one.
Well, wasn't that an interesting chat with Russell, to look at the advocacy work he does and why he is so passionate about helping these men and women who have been victims of child sexual abuse?
The depth and breadth of what he's doing. I think he said 17,000 people have approached
17,400 people so far. I mean, that blew my mind, that
statistic.
With
the team behind him, but it speaks to the depth of the problem, and I'm sure that's still just the tip of the iceberg. But he must be doing a good job to have such a following, and I'm not surprised by that at all.
What really interests me as well is his commitment to actually changing the system. You know, lots of young people are going to prison. Youth justice is a problem. We know that simply locking up young people doesn't work. We do need to look at trauma-informed methods of diverting these young people, looking at their backgrounds, trying to understand why they're engaging in these behaviours, because ultimately, Russell is an example of what happens you know, the early part of his life if you don't manage those traumas and deal with them. And he's turned it around, but so many people don't have the opportunity or resilience necessarily to be able to achieve what Russell has. And he shared his ongoing struggles with us, so it's certainly not an easy path to take. And I think that's something that's really powerful that's come out of this, and I'd love to work with him in that space to see whether youth justice outcomes can be improved.
That'll be fabulous. I must say that his story, with great respect to Russell, is not unique in terms of that escalation of crime trajectory. It often starts with what we'd describe as petty crime, although these days younger people are committing more serious crimes than, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But once they're on the treadmill, it's very hard to get off. And I must say, you don't see a lot of older crooks who suffer drug addiction, because they either get clean or they die. But you do see older crooks who just can't get off the treadmill, and they keep committing offences and getting longer and longer sentences. So what he's doing in terms of sharing his story, I think, provides a lot of credibility to his audience. It's one thing for you know, straight people to get up and give a bit of a spiel about where your life is headed. I've been doing it for a long time, but it's something else when it comes from somebody who has lived the experience. And I think that, you know, is part of the success story with him. He's honest about it. He doesn't pull his punches in terms of what happened to him. And consequently, he gains credibility and respect. I certainly also would like to assist him if I can, as I think it'd be a good thing.
Yeah, I think he's a real inspiration and role model to a lot of people. And I think getting his story out there is important, but equally that it's still a struggle. He still struggles with some of those issues. And I think that's important, that there's no weakness in that, recognizing more positive ways of managing it. And again, I think that can help other people deal with their own demons. And I really hope that people take strength from his successes, so they can see that it is possible for them to choose a different path as well if they seem stuck on that treadmill.
Well, he learned that talking about it helped him. And one of the striking things too about his story was that it was decades before he actually opened up about his history. He was clammed up and traumatized. So from the age of, what, 16 to 48, did he say?
Yeah.
There was no discussion about this at all. And again, it was the Royal Commission and the good work done by those commissioners that enabled him to feel safe enough and validated enough to come forward. And it's quite a remarkable story for a guy with such an intense prior history to have turned his life around so majestically, if I could put it
that way. Absolutely. Thank you for listening to Motive and Method. And remember, if you're loving the show, you can give us a review, you can subscribe to our channel and feed, and you can recommend us to friends and family. You can also set up a bell notification alert so that you'll know first when a new episode is available.
I'm Tim Watson-Munro.
And I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.